"Is there anyone here," said Locke quietly, "who'd rather leave the gang than go to Espara?"
"There'd better not be," said Galdo.
"The billiard ball's right for once," said Carlo. "It's not as though I'm enthusiastic about this, but anyone who wants to leave can do it head first off the temple roof."
"Good," said Locke. "Then we need to talk. Get some ink and parchment."
"Count the money," said Sabatha.
"I'll fetch some wine," said Jean. "Strong wine."
5. They were far from comfortable together. The Sansas sat on opposite sides of the table, and Sabatha leaned against a chair pushed away from everyone else. Yet they all seemed to grasp the urgency of their situation. Over the course of 2 bottles of Verrari lemon wine, they hashed out mostly civil arguments and scratched up lists of supplies and responsibilities.
"Right then," said Locke, when his glass was empty and his note-pages full, "Sabatha will try to scare up any portions of the Republic of Thieves from the shops and scribes, so we can all have a look at it on the road."
"I've got some other Lucano plays I'll pack," said Jean, "and some Mercallo Montezzo dross I'm not so fond of, but we should all study them and pick up some lines."
"Jean and I will find a wagon and get us in with a caravan master," said Locke. He passed one of his lists over to Galdo. "The Sansas will pack the common goods and supplies."
"We need aliases," said Sabatha. "We can smooth out our stories on the way, but we should have our game names ready to use."
"Who do you want to be, then?" said Jean.
"Call me Verina. Verina Galante."
"Lucasa," said Locke. "I'll be Lucasa de Barra."
"Must you?" said Sabatha.
"Must I what?"
"You always have to choose an alias that starts with L, and Jean nearly always goes for a J."
"Keeps things simple," said Jean. "And now, just because you've said that, I'll be Giovanno. Hell, Locke and I can be first cousins. I'll be Giovanno de Barra."
"False names are fun," said Carlo. "Call me Beefwit Smallcock."
"These are aliases, not biographical sketches," said Galdo.
"Fine, then," said Carlo. "Lend me a hand. There's a masculine form of Sabatha, isn't there?"
"Sabazzo," said Galdo, snapping his fingers.
"Yeah, Sabazzo. I'll be Sabazzo."
"Like hell you will," said Sabatha.
"Hey, I know," said Galdo. "I'll be Jean. You can call yourself Locke."
"You two will crap splinters for a month after I make you eat this table," said Jean.
"Well, if you put it like that," said Carlo, "why don't we use our middle names? I'll be Giacomo, and you can be Castellano."
"Might work," said Galdo grudgingly. "Need a last name."
"Asino," said Carlo. "It's thrown Therin for donkey."
"Gods lend me strength," said Sabatha.
6.
"Master de Barra,"
said Anatoly Vireska 2 nights later, looking up with a smile that put every gap in his teeth on display, like archery ports in a crumbling fortress wall. The rangy, middle-aged Vadran caravan master gave the gentleman bastard's wagon a friendly thump as Jean brought their team of 4 horses to a halt.
"And company, you picked a good time to show up."
"I've seen this place when it's busy."
Locke glanced backward at the Mill Falls district and the Street of 7 Wheels, which lay under the strange party-coloured haze of fading false light. Traffic on the cobbled road itself was sparse, since few business travellers came or went from the Cenza gate as darkness was falling.
"Figured we might get a jump on the chaos."
"Just so. Pull up anywhere in the commons beneath the wall. Now, if you want more than half-assed shelter, there's the Andrazi stable down the lane to the right, and the Umbolo stable just yonder, the one with all the mules. Andrazi tips me a few coppers a week to point people her way, but I wouldn't take the money if I didn't think her place was the better bargain, hey?"
"Duly noted," said Jean.
"Want me to send a boy around to help with your horses? I could have my outfitter check your packing, too."
"I'm sure we're fine, thanks," said Locke.
"Glad to hear it. Just so we're clear, though, my guards don't stand to duty until we line up all our ducklings tomorrow morning. As long as we're behind walls, your security is your own business. Given that you're bedding down 20 yards from a watch barracks, I wouldn't lose any sleep over it."
"Nor shall we."
Jean waved farewell and convinced the horses to take them into the shadow of Camorra's walls.
Rickety overhanging panels topped about 100 yards worth of barren common space in the lee of the wall, where those unwilling or unable to pay for service at the commercial stables could pull in. Sabatha, Carlo, and Galdo piled out of the back of the open-topped wagon as it rolled to a stop.
1/4 mile down, a mere 200 to go, said Locke. The humid air was heavy with the smells of old hay, animal sweat, and droppings. Other travellers were lighting lanterns, laying out bedrolls, and starting cooking fires. There were at least 12 wagon parties stopped beside the wall. Locke wondered idly how many of them were bound for Espara as part of Vereska's caravan.
"Let's get you fixed up for the night, boys."
Jean hopped down from the wagon and gave a reassuring pat to the flank of the nearest cart-horse. Jean had spent several months in the role of a teamster's apprentice 2 years earlier, and had assumed responsibility for driving and tending their animals without complaint. The team represented a significant portion of the money Chains had given them, but could be resold in Espara to flesh out their temporarily thinned finances.
"Sweep beneath the wagon, would you, Giacomo?" said Galdo. "Don't want turds for pillows." "Sweep it your fucking self, Castellano," said Carlo. "Nobody put you in charge."
"Mind yourself," whispered Sabatha, grabbing Carlo by the arm. "We've got 10 days on the road ahead of us. Do they have to be a miserable trial for no good reason?"
"I'm not his damn valet," said Carlo.
"That's right." Locke stepped between the Sansas, thinking quickly. "None of us are. We'll share sweeping duties, all of us. Carlo starts tonight."
"I'm Giacomo."
"Right, sorry. Giacomo starts tonight. Other brother when we stop tomorrow. I'll take the night after that, and so on. A fair rotation. Good enough?"
"I can live with it," muttered Carlo.
"I'm not afraid to get my hands dirty. Just won't have him putting on airs." Locke ground his teeth together. The Sansas had spent the last several months steadily discarding their old habits of synchronicity in action and appearance. They took pains to distinguish themselves from one another, and their differences in grooming were the merest outward flourishes of the phenomenon. Locke would never have begrudged the twins an individualistic phase, but their timing was awkward as hell, and their ongoing spats were like fresh wood heaped on an already rising fire.
"Look,"
said Locke, realizing that the gang's mechanisms of fellowship needed oiling rather badly. "With so many taverns close at hand, I don't see any need for us to torture ourselves with boiled beef and bag water. I'll fetch us something more pleasing."
"We have the coin for that sort of luxury?" said Sabatha.
"I might have cut a purse or two while I was out this morning, just for the sake of, financial flexibility." Locke shuffled his feet and cleared his throat. "You want to come with?"
"You need me to?"
"Well, I'd like you to."
"Hmm."
She stared at him for a few seconds, during which Locke experienced the curious sensation of his heart apparently sinking several inches deeper into his chest. Then she shrugged.
"I suppose."
They left Jean with the horses, Galdo watching their supplies, and Carlo gingerly cleaning the ground beneath the wagon. There was a well-lit tavern at the end of the lane beside the wall, just past the Andrazi stable, and by unspoken mutual consent they headed toward it in the gathering darkness. Locke stole a glance at Sabatha as they walked. Her tightly bound hair was further packed beneath a close-fitting linen cap, and all of her clothing was long and loose, disguising her curves. It was the sort of dress a prudent, mild, and unassertive young woman would choose for the road, and as such it suited Sabatha not at all. Still, she wore it as well as anyone could, as far as Locke's eyes were concerned.
"I was, hoping I could talk to you," he said. "Easily done," said Sabatha. "Open your mouth and let words come out."
"Look, can you please not be glib with me?
Requesting miracles now, are we?"
Sabatha looked down and kicked a stone out of her path.
"Look, I'm sorry. Contemplating 10 days stuck together on the road, and the brothers being, you know, the whole thing has me feeling like a hedgehog, rolled up with my spikes out. Can't help myself."
"Oh, a hedgehog is absolutely the last thing I would ever compare you to," said Locke with a laugh.
"Interesting," said Sabatha, "that I mention my own feelings, and you seem to think that what I'm after is reassurance concerning your perceptions."
"But..." Locke felt another knot in his chest. Conversations with Sabatha always seemed to call his attention to malfunctioning internal mysteries he hadn't previously known he possessed.
Look, come on. Do you have to dissect everything I say, pin it up like an anatomist and sift through it? First I'm too glib, now I'm cutting too fine. Surely you should be pleased to be receiving such close attention to what you're actually saying.
You know, said Locke, feeling his hands shake nervously with the thought of what he was about to put in the open,
you know that when I'm around you, I find it very easy to shove my foot into my mouth, sometimes both feet, and you do see it.
She said. More than that, you make use of the advantage.
I do. She looked at him strangely. You fancy me.
That, said Locke, feeling thunderstruck, that is, really, not how I would have...
Not as grand in plain speech as it is up here?
She tapped her forehead.
Sabatha, I value your good opinion more than anything in the world. It kills me not to have it. It kills me not to know whether I have it. We've lived together all these years, and still there's this fog between us. I don't know what I did to put it there, but I would throw myself under a cart to lift it, believe me. Why do you assume it's something you've done, something you can undo at will? I'm not some arithmetic problem just waiting for you to show your work properly, Locke. Did you ever think that I might... Gods, you've got me stumbling now. That I might be actively contributing to this... to our awkwardness?
Actively contributing?
Yes, as though I might have warm-blooded motives of my own, being as I'm not an oil painting or some other decorative object of desire.
Do you like me? Said Locke, shocked at himself for blurting the question out. It was an invitation to have his heart laid out and smashed on an anvil, and there were a thousand things she could say that would do the hammer's work.
At all? Do I ever please you with my company? Am I at least preferable to an empty room?
There are times when the empty room is a sore temptation.
But, of course I like you, she said, raising her hands as though to touch him reassuringly. She didn't complete the gesture. You can be clever and enterprising and charming, though rarely all three at once, and I do sometimes admire you, if it helps you to hear it.
It means everything to hear it, he said, feeling the tightness in his chest turn to buoyant warmth.
It's worth a thousand embarrassments just to hear it, because I feel the same way about you.
You don't feel the same way about me, she said.
Oh, but I do, he said, without qualifying remarks even. That's...
Hey there!
A polished club came down on Locke's shoulder, a gentle tap, yet impossible to ignore. The club was attached to a heavy-set man in the leather harness and mustard-yellow coat of the city watch, attended by a younger comrade carrying a lantern on a pole.
"You're in the middle of a lane," said the big yellow jacket. "Not a bloody drawing-room. Move it elsewhere."
"Oh, of course, sir,"
said Locke in one of his better respectable citizen voices. This constable, not being agitated, didn't require the use of Locke's very best. He and Sabatha moved off the lane and into the shadows beneath the wall, where fireflies sketched pale green arcs against the darkness.
"No one thinks of anyone else without qualifying remarks," said Sabatha. "I love Chains dearly, and still he and I have disappointed one another. I'll always be fond of the Sansas, but right now I wish they'd go away for a year. And you—"
"I've frustrated you, I know.
And I've returned the favour."
She did touch him now, gently, on his upper left arm, and it took most of his self-control not to jump out of his shoes.
"Nobody admires anyone else without qualification. If they do, they're after an image, not a person."
"Well," said Locke, "in that case I harbour a great many resentments, reservations, and suspicions about you. Does that please you better?"
"You're trying to be charming again," she said softly. "But I choose not to be charmed, Locke Lamora, not with things as they stand."
"Can I make amends for whatever I've done to frustrate you?"
"That's complicated."
"I like to think that I take hints as well as anyone," said Locke. "Why not throw some at my head?"
"Going to be a lot of time to kill between here and Aspara, I suppose. Can we speak again tomorrow night, after we've stopped?" "The gentleman requests the favour of a personal engagement tomorrow evening?"
"At the lady's pleasure, before the dancing and iced wine, immediately following the grand sweep beneath the wagon for stray horse shit."
"I may consent."
"Then life is worth living."
"Don't be a dunce," she said. We should do our business at the tavern and get back before the Sansas try to sneak off to the Gilded Lilies one last time. They came away from the tavern with cold boiled chicken, olives, black bread, and 2 skins of yellow wine with a flavor somewhere between turpentine and wasp piss. Simple as it was, the meal was ducal indulgence compared to the salted meat and hardtack waiting in crates on the back of their wagon. They ate in silence, distracted by the sight of the 5 towers shining in the oncoming night and by hungry insects. Jean volunteered to sit first watch. No Camori ever born, least of all one who'd made it out of Shades Hill, would blithely trust to Providence even in the literal shadow of a city watch barracks. After acknowledging this noble sacrifice, the other 4 curled up beneath the wagon, sweaty and mosquito-plagued, to bed down. It occurred to Locke that this was technically the first time he and Sabitha had ever slept together in any sense of the term, even if they were separated by nothing less than a complete pair of Sansa twins.
"We crawl before we walk," he sighed to himself. "We walk before we run."
"Hey,"
whispered Galdo, who was curled against his back.
"You don't fart in your sleep, do you?"
"How would you be able to detect a fart over your natural odor, Sansa?"
"For shame,"
said Galdo. "There's no Sansas here, remember. I'm an Asino."
"Oh, yes," said Locke with a yawn. "Yes, you certainly are."
Chapter 5. The 5-Year Game. Starting Position. 1.
"Sabitha's in Carthane," said Locke.
"She could hardly do the job from elsewhere," said Patience.
"Sabitha! My Sabitha!
I marvel at such a confident assertion of possession."
"Our Sabitha, then. The Sabitha. How do you people know so god's damned much about my life? How did you find her?"
"I didn't," said Patience, "nor do I know how it was done. All I know is that her instructions and resources will mirror your own."
"Except she has a head start," said Jean, easing Locke back into his chair. The expression on Locke's face was that of a prize fighter who'd just received a proper thunderbolt to the chin.
"And she's working alone," said Patience, "whereas you two have one another. So one might hope that her positional advantage will be purely temporary. Or is she really that much of a tiger to set you both quaking?"
"I'm not quaking," said Locke quietly. "It's just so god's damned unexpected."
"You've always hoped for a reunion, haven't you?"
"On my own terms," said Locke. "Does she know that it's us she's up against? Did she know before she took the job?"
"Yes," said Patience.
"Your opposition? They didn't do anything to her?"
"As far as I'm aware, she required no compulsion."
"This is hard to take," said Locke. "Gentlemen bastards, well, we trained against one another, and we've quarrelled, obviously, but we've never actually opposed one another, not for real."
"Given that she's completely removed herself from your company for so many years now," said Patience, "how can you believe that she still considers herself part of your gang?"
"Thank you for that, Patience," growled Jean. "Do you have anything else for us? If not, I think we need to—"
"Yes, I'm sure you do. The cabin is yours."
She withdrew. Locke put his head in his hands and sighed. "I don't expect life to make sense," he said after a few moments, "but it would certainly be pleasant if it would stop kicking us in the balls." "Don't you want to see her again?" "Of course I want to see her again," said Locke. "I always meant to find her. I meant to do it in Camor. I meant to do it after we'd made a big score in Tal Verar. I just... you know how it's all gone. She's not going to be impressed."
"Maybe she wants to see you," said Jean. "Maybe she leapt at the chance when the Bonds Magi approached her. Maybe she's already tried to hunt us down."
"Gods, what if she did? I wonder what she made of the mess we left behind in Camor. I just can't believe working against her. Those bastards."
"Hey, we're just supposed to fix an election," said Jean. "Nobody's going to hurt her, least of all us."
"I hope," said Locke, brightening. "I hope—" "Damn, I have no idea what to hope."
He spent a few minutes nibbling at his food in a nervous daze, while Jean sipped his warm red plonk.
"I do know this," Locke said at last. "On the business side of things, we're already in the shit."
"Up to our elbows,"
said Jean. Given a choice, I would have grudged her a 10-minute head start, let alone a few days.
Makes me think back to when chains used to play you two off one another, said Jean. All those arguments, all those stalemates, then more arguments.
Don't think I don't remember. Locke tapped a piece of biscuit distractedly against the table.
Well, hell, it's been 5 years. Maybe she's learned to lose gracefully. Maybe she's out of practice. Maybe trained monkeys will climb out of my arse and pour me a glass of Ostershell in brandy, said Jean.
2. Dawn came over the Amethel the next morning. A hazy golden-orange ribbon rose from the eastern horizon, and the calm, dark waters mirrored the cobalt sky. A dozen fishing boats were moving past the Sky Reacher in a swarm, their triangular white wakes giving the small craft the appearance of arrowheads passing in dreamlike slow motion. Carthane itself was coming up to larboard, not half a mile away. From the quarterdeck, Jean could see the clean white terraces of the city, bulwarked with thick rows of olive and cypress and witchwood trees, misted with a silver morning fog that gave him an unexpected pang for Camor. A blocky stone lighthouse dominated the city's waterfront, though at the moment its great golden lanterns were banked down so that their glow was no more than a warm aura crowning the tower. Locke leaned against the taffrail, staring at the approaching city, eating cold beef and hard white cheese he'd piled awkwardly into his right hand. Locke had paced the great cabin most of the night, unable or unwilling to sleep, settling into his hammock only to rest his unsteady legs.
How do you feel?
Patience, wrapped in a long coat and shawl, chose not to appear out of thin air, but approached them on foot.
Ill-used, said Locke.
At least you're alive to feel that way.
No need to drop hints. You'll get your command performance out of us, never worry about that.
I wasn't worried, she said sweetly. Here comes our dock detail.
Dock detail?
Jean glanced past Patience and saw a long, low, double-banked boat rowed by 20 people approaching behind the last of the fishing boats.
To bring the Sky Reacher in, said Patience, and mind her lines and sails and other tedious articles.
Not in the mood to wiggle your fingers and square everything away, said Locke.
One of the few things that we agree upon, exceptionalists and conservatives alike, is that our arts don't exist for the sake of swabbing decks.
The dock detail came aboard at the ship's waist, a very ordinary-looking pack of sailors. Patience beckoned for Locke and Jean to follow her as two of the newcomers took the wheel.
I do assume you're carrying your hatchets, Jean, and all of the documents I gave you?
Of course.
Then you shouldn't mind going ashore immediately.
She led them to the Sky Reacher's larboard waist, where Jean could see four sailors still waiting in the boat. It was an easy trip down the boarding net, just 7 or 8 feet. Even Locke made it without mishap, and then Patience, who evidently required a hoist only when gravity wasn't on her side.
"Some of your people are waiting on the pier," she said as she settled onto a rowing bench. "They're all sensible of the urgency of the situation."
"Our people," said Locke.
"As of now, they're entirely your people. The arrangement of their affairs is in your hands."
"And they'll just do as we say? To what extent?"
"To a reasonable extent, Locke.
Nobody will fling themselves into the lake at your whim, but you two are now the de facto heads of the Deep Roots Party's election apparatus. Functionaries will take your orders. Candidates will kiss your boots."
The sailors pushed them away from the Sky Reacher and pulled for the lantern-lit waterfront.
"This is the Ponta Corbessa," said Patience, gesturing ahead. "The city wharf. I take it neither of you knows much about this place?"
"Our former plan was to avoid Carthane, forever," said Jean.
"Your new associates will acquaint you with everything. Give it a few days and you'll be very comfortable, I'm sure."
Said Locke.
"Speaking of comfort, there is one last thing I should mention."
"And that is?" said Locke.
"You will, of course, be free to communicate with Sabatha in whatever fashion she allows, but collusion will not be acceptable. You are opponents. You will oppose and be opposed, without quarter. We're paying you to see a contest. disappoint us in that regard, and I can assure you not getting paid will be the least of your worries.
Give the threats a rest, said Locke. You'll get your God's damned contest.
The longboat drew up against a stone quay. Jean clambered out of the boat and heaved Locke up after him, then grudgingly offered his arm to Patience. She took it with a nod. They were in the shadow of the lighthouse now, on a stretch of cobbled waterfront backed by warehouses and shuttered shops. A sparse forest of masts rose behind the buildings, probably some sort of lagoon, Jean thought, where ships could rest in safety. The area was strangely deserted, save for a small group of people standing beside a carriage.
Patience, said Jean. What should we... Ah, hell!
Patience had vanished. The sailors in the longboat pushed off without a word and headed back toward the Sky Reacher.
Bitch knows how to make an exit, said Locke.
He popped the last of his meat and cheese into his mouth and wiped his hands on his tunic.
Excuse me!
A heavy-set young man in a grey brocade coat broke from the group at the carriage.
You must be Masters Callas and Lazari.
We must, said Jean, flashing a friendly smile.
Pray give us a moment.
Oh, said the man, who possessed the true Carthani accent, which was something like the speech of a Lashani after a few strong drinks.
Of course.
Now, said Jean quietly, turning to Locke,
who are we?
A pair of rats about to stick their noses into a big fucking trap.
Characters, you git. Lazari and Callas. We should settle the particulars before we start talking to people.
All right. Locke scratched his chin. We've got no time to practice Carthani accents, so to hell with hiding that we're from out of town.
Less work suits me, said Jean.
Good. Then we need to decide who's the Iron Fist and who's the Velvet Glove.
Sounds like something you should be hiring a couple of strumpets to help you with.
I'd hit you if I thought it would do any good, Jean. You know what I mean.
Right, let's be obvious. Me brute, you weasel.
Agreed. You brute, me charming mastermind. But there's no sense in setting things too taut before we even know who we're dealing with. Be a brute that plays nice until provoked.
So we're not actually playing characters at all, then?
Well, hell. Locke cracked his knuckles and shrugged. It's one less detail for us to muck up. Anyway, Patience said these people would eat out of our hands. Let's put that to the test.
Now then,
said Jean, turning back to the heavyset young man,
start talking again.
I'm delighted to see you alive and well, gentlemen.
The stranger came closer, and Jean noted his round, ruddy features, the look of a man eager to please and be pleased. And yet his eyes, behind slender optics, were shrewd and measuring. His hair had failed to retain any sort of hold on the areas forward of his ears, but he had a thick and well-tended plait that hung, black as a raven's wing, to the small of his back.
When we heard about the wreck, we were distraught. The Amethyll is lately so mild, it's hard to credit.
Wreck, said Locke.
Ah, yes, the wreck. Yes, the terrible, convenient wreck. What else could compel us to be here without decent clothing or purses? Well, I'm afraid everything happened in such a terrible rush, but I'm told that we survived.
Ha! Splendid! Fear nothing, gentlemen. I'm here to mend your situation in every particular. My name is Nikoros.
Sebastian Lazari. Locke extended his hand. Nikoros shook it with a look of surprise on his face.
Tavrin Callas, said Jean.
Nikoros' grip was dry and firm.
Well, I say thank you, gentlemen, thank you. What an unexpected mark of confidence. I take it very kindly.
Mark of confidence? Said Locke.
Forgive us, Nikoros. We're new to Carthane. I'm not sure we understand what we've done.
Oh, said Nikoros. Damned stupid of me. I apologize. It's just that... Well, you'll probably think us such a pack of credulous ninnies, but I assure you, it's tradition. Here in Carthane, we're close, extremely close, with our given names, on account of, you know, the presence.
It was easy enough for Jean to hear the capital P as Nikoros pronounced the word.
You mean, he said, the bonds?
Yes, the magi of the Issa Scholastica. When we speak of the presence, well, we're just being polite. We're quite used to them, really.
They're not the objects of curiosity. They might be elsewhere. In fact, I can assure you they look almost like ordinary people. You'd be amazed.
I don't doubt it, said Locke.
Well, this is useful stuff. I take it we should withhold our given names when we're introduced to Carthani?
Well, yes, it's the hoariest old superstition, but it's been our custom since the fall of the old throne. Most of us use birth order titles or nicknames. I'm called Nikoros Vialupa, since my office is on the Avenue of the Wolves, but plain Nikoros suits as well.
We're obliged to you, said Jean. Now, what is it that you do, exactly?
I'm a trade insurer, ships and caravans, but, more relevantly, I'm on the Deep Roots Party Standing Committee. I'm sort of a shepherd for party business.
You have real authority over party affairs?
Oh, quite. Funds and operations with some latitude. But, when it comes to that, gentlemen, my most important duty is to carry out your instructions. Once I've helped you settle in, of course.
And you understand the nature of our employment, said Locke. The real nature of it, that is.
Oh, quite.
Nikoros tapped the side of his nose with a finger several times and smiled. Those of us at the top understand that half the fight is, well, unconventional. We're all for it. After all, the Black Iris are out to do the same to us. We think they might even bring in specialists like yourselves.
Be assured they have, said Locke. How long have you been involved with all this?
Party business, you mean?
Oh, 10 years or so. It's the biggest thing going socially. More fun than billiards. I worked with our specialist last election. We pulled off 9 seats and nearly won. We have such hopes this time around.
Well, said Jean, the sooner we're settled in, the sooner we can nourish those hopes.
Right, to the carriage. We'll get you two wrapped up in something more suitable.
He beckoned, and a slender blonde woman in a black velvet jacket met them halfway as they moved toward the carriage.
Allow me to present second daughter Morena, Morena Clothiers.
Your servant.
She curtsied, and a brass-weighted measuring line appeared in her hands as swiftly as an assassin's knife.
It seems you have a sartorial emergency.
Yes, said Locke. Circumstance has flung us down and danced upon us.
Clothes first, said Nikoros as he hustled Locke and Jean into the enclosed carriage box. Then we'll see to your funds. Morena came last. Nikoros drew the door shut and pounded on the underside of the carriage roof. As it rattled off, Morena seized the collar of Locke's slop jacket and pulled him firmly to a hunched-over standing position.
I beg your deepest pardon, she muttered,
plying her measuring line around his neck and shoulders. We usually keep a fellow on hand at the shop to take the measurements of our gentleman customers, but he's taken ill. I assure you that I make these intrusions as impersonally as a physicker.
It would never occur to me to be offended, said Locke in a dazed voice.
Marvelous. If you'll excuse me, sir, we'll just need to have your jacket off.
She somehow managed to fold, wrench, and twirl Locke within the confined space, removing his jacket at last and causing a small rain of twice-baked ship's biscuits to patter around the carriage interior.
Oh, my, I had no idea.
Not your fault, said Locke with an embarrassed cough. I like to feed birds.
Under his arms, around his chest, along the outside of his legs, Morena took measurements from Locke with the speed of a fencer scoring touches. Soon it was Jean's turn.
"Same thing, sir," she muttered while she fussed with his coat.
"There's no need, if you'll give me a moment," said Jean, but it was too late.
"Heavens," said Morena as she pulled his hatchets out of their makeshift hiding place at the small of his back, "these have seen some use."
"I've had to settle the occasional misunderstanding."
"Do you prefer to carry them tucked away like this under a coat or jacket?"
"There's nowhere better."
"Then I can show you several rigs that could be stitched into your coats. We've got leather harness, cloth straps, metal rings, all reliable and discreet. Tuck a whole arsenal into your breeches and waistcoats if you like."
"You're my new favorite tailor," said Jean,
contentedly submitting to the darting play of the measuring line while the carriage rolled along. 3.
Their journey took about 10 minutes, while the sun rose and painted the walls and alleys around them with warm light. Jean took advantage of his window seat to form several impressions of Carthane along the way. The first was that it was a city of tiered heights. As they moved inward from the waterfront, past the ship-filled lagoon, he saw that the more northerly sections of the city rose, hills and terraces alike, to a sort of plateau that must have been several hundred feet above the Ponta Corbessa. Nothing so extreme as Tal Vara's precipitous drops, but it did seem as though the gods or the Eldrin had tilted the city about 45 degrees toward the water after originally laying it out. Furthermore, it seemed to be an unusually well-tended place. Perhaps Nikoros had chosen a route that would best flatter his city? Whatever the case, Jean couldn't fail to note the swept streets, the clean white stone of the newer houses, the neatly trimmed trees, the smooth bubbling of every fountain and waterfall, or the decorative enamel mosaics on the cable cars sliding between the taller buildings. Most striking was the character of the city's elderglass. Its bridges over the wide Carvanou, which poured down 5 separate white foaming falls before it reached the heart of the city, were not solid arches, but rather suspension bridges made of thousands of panels of milky black elderglass, connected by countless finger-thick lengths of glass cable to supporting towers like spindly caricatures of human temple spires. The first bridge they crossed had a disconcerting amount of sway and bounce, just a few inches of give, to be sure, but any bounce at all was of immediate interest to someone high over water in a carriage.
"Never fear," said Nikoros, noticing the matching expressions on Locke's and Jean's faces. "You'll be used to this in no time. It's elder glass. Nothing we do could so much as fray a cable."
Jean stared at the other huge bridges spanning the Carvanou. They looked like the work of mad giant spiders, or harps designed for hands the size of palaces. He also noted, for the first time, a strangely tuneful humming and creaking that he assumed was the music of the cables.
"Welcome to the Isas Salviero," said Nikoros,
when the carriage halted a few minutes later, blessedly back on unyielding stone.
"A business district, one of the pumping hearts of the city. My office is just north of here."
The small group bustled out of the carriage and into Morena Clothiers, where they found a wide shop floor surrounded by a raised second-floor gallery. Second daughter Morena locked the door behind them.
"These aren't our usual hours," she said. "You're an emergency case."
There was a strong smell of coffee wafting throughout the shop, and Jean's mouth watered. The walls of the lower room were layered with bolts of cloth in 100 different colors and textures, while several wooden racks of coats and jackets had been brought out into the middle of the floor.
"Allow me to introduce first daughter Morena," said second daughter, pointing to a taller, heavier blonde woman on the upper level who was pulling a gleaming metallic thread from a rattling clockwork spindle. "And of course our darling third daughter."
The youngest of the tailoring sisters was as petite as second daughter, though her hair was a shade darker, and she alone of the three wore optics. She was absorbed in trimming some unknown velvet bundle with a pair of blackened iron shears, and she gave the merest nod in greeting.
"Thimbles on, girls, it's time for battle," said second daughter.
"My,"
said first daughter, who stepped away from her machine and descended to the first floor.
"Shipwreck, was it? You gentlemen look like you've been in the wars. Is La Chaine having some sort of difficulty?"
"La Chaine is its old charming self, madam," said Locke. "Our misfortune was personal."
"You've come to the right place. We adore a challenge, and we adorn the challenged. Second, have you taken their measurements?"
"Everything I could in decency."
Second daughter snatched up a slate, and with a squeaky piece of chalk scribed 2 columns of numbers on it. She threw the slate to first daughter.
"Save for the breeches in seams. Could you be a dear?"
First daughter conjured a measuring line in her free hand and advanced on Locke and Jean without hesitation.
"Now, gentlemen, our male apprentice is out sick, so you'll need to bear my scrutiny a moment. Take heart, there's many a wife that won't give her husband this sort of attention for love or money."
Chuckling, she took rapid and mostly professional measurements from crotch to ankles on both men, then added some squiggles to the bottom of the slate.
"I assume that we're replacing an entire wardrobe,"
said third daughter, setting her velvet down.
Yes, said Locke. These fine dish-rags represent the sum of our current wardrobe.
You've the sound of an Easterner, said third daughter. Will you want the style to which you're accustomed, or something more?
Local, said Jean. Absolutely local. Fit us out like natives.
It will take several days, said second daughter, holding a swatch of something brown up to Jean's neck and frowning, to deliver all the bespoke work, you understand, and that's with us chugging along like water engines. But while we're arranging that, we can set you up with something respectable enough.
We don't do boots, though, said first daughter, stripping Jean's jacket and sending his hatchets clattering to the floor.
Oh, dear! Will you be wanting somewhere to tuck those?
Absolutely, said Jean.
We've got a thousand ways, said first.
She picked up the wicked sisters and set them respectfully on a table.
But as I was saying, Nicoros, we haven't turned cobblers in the last few hours. Have you kept that in mind?
Of course, said Nicoros. This is but the first stop. I'll have them set up like royalty before lunch.
The next half hour was a furious storm of fittings, removals, tests, measurements, re-measurements, suggestions, counter-suggestions, and sisterly arguments as Locke and Jean were gradually peeled out of their slops and re-skinned as fair approximations of gentlemen. The creamy silk shirts were a little too big, the vests and breeches taken in or let out with some haste. Locke's long coat hung loose, and Jean's was tight across the chest. Still, it was a drastic improvement, at least from the ankles up. Now they could set foot in a counting house without provoking the guards into raising weapons. Once the immediate transmutation was accomplished, the three women took notes for a more expansive wardrobe, evening coats, morning jackets, formal and informal waistcoats, breeches in half a dozen styles, velvet doublets, fitted silk shirts, and all the trimmings.
Now, you said you'd be doing more, entertaining, as it were, said third daughter to Locke. So I gather you'll need a slightly wider selection of coats than your friend Master Callus.
Entirely correct, said Jean,
rolling his arms around and enjoying his restoration to a state of elegance, tight coat or no.
Besides, I'm the careful one. I can make do with less. Give my friend a bit more of your attention.
As you will, said third daughter, gently but firmly grabbing Jean by his left cuff.
A long dangling thread had caught her attention. She had her shears out with a graceful twirl and snipped it in the blink of an eye.
There, squared away. I believe, then, we'll start with 7 coats for Master Lazari and give you 4.
We'll send them to your inn as we finish them, said first daughter, tallying figures on a new slate. These figures had nothing to do with Locke's and Jean's measurements. She passed the slate to Nicoros, and when he nodded curtly, her pleasure was readily apparent.
Lovely, said Locke, except we don't know where we're staying just yet.
The Deep Roots party does, said Nicoros with a half bow. You're in our bosom now, sirs. You'll want for nothing. Now, might I beg you to come along just a few steps up the lane? Those bare feet will never do for lunch or dinner.
4. The next 2 hours of the morning were spent, as Nicoros had prophesied, scuttling up and down the streets of the Isas Salviero in pursuit of boots, shoes, jewelry, and every last detail that would help Locke and Jean pass as men of real account. Several of the shops involved had not yet opened for regular business, but the force of Nicoros' connections and pocketbook unlocked every door. As their list of immediate needs grew shorter, Jean noticed that Locke was spending more and more time eyeballing the alleys, windows, and rooftops around them.
Behavior very obvious, he signaled. Threat God's damned serious, was the reply.
And despite himself, despite personal experience that one of the least intelligent things to do when you fear being spied upon is to crane your head in all directions and advertise your suspicion, Jean did just that. As the carriage rattled toward Tivoli's counting house, he stole fretful glances out of his window. Sabatha. Gods below, he couldn't imagine a more troublesome foe. Not only had he and Locke set foot in a city where their presence was expected, she knew precisely how they worked. That was true in reverse, to some extent, but all the same he felt like they were just leaving the starting mark in a race that had been going on without them for some time.
"'Think she'll hit us early?' said Jean.
"'She's hitting us as we speak,' muttered Locke. "'We just don't know where yet.'
"'Gentlemen!' said Nikoros, who was working to keep the pile of parcels on the seat next to him from toppling onto the compartment floor at every turn. "'What's troubling you?'
"'Our opposition,' said Locke. "'The Black Aris people. "'Is there a woman that you know of, a new woman, only recently arrived?'
"'The red-headed woman, you mean?' said Nikoros. "'Is she important?'
"'She—' Locke seemed to think better of whatever he was about to say. "'She's our problem.' Don't tell anyone we asked, but keep your ears open.
We haven't identified her yet, said Nikoros. She's not Karthani.
No, said Locke, she's not. Do you have any idea where she is?
I could show you a few coffee houses and taverns run by Black Iris members, not to mention the sign of the Black Iris itself. They got their name from that place. If I had to guess, I'd look for her there.
I'll want a list of all those places, said Locke. Get me the name of every business, every inn, every hole in the wall connected with the Aris people. Write them down. I'll have papers sent out to you while we're in Tivoli's.
I fancy I can give you something useful off the top of my head. Do you want something more complete later? I have membership lists, property lists.
I'll want it all, said Locke. Make copies. Do you have a scribe you trust, really trust?
I have a bonded scrivener I've used forever. "'Said Nikoros. "'He votes deep roots.
"'Have the poor bastard cancel his life for a day or two,' said Locke. "'Pay him whatever he asks. "'I assume you can tug on the party's purse strings at will.'
"'Well, yes.
"'Good. "'Because that teat is about to be milked. "'Have your scribe copy everything important. "'Everything. "'Anything election-related goes to us. "'Anything personal goes to your counting-house vault.'
"'But why—'
For the next month and a half, I expect you to behave as though your office is in danger of burning down at any moment.
But surely they wouldn't.
Nothing is off the table. Nothing. Got it?
If you insist.
Maybe we'll have a meeting with the opposition sooner or later, said Locke. Set some rules. Until then, a bad accident is a near certainty. I know if I could get at someone like you on the Black Aris side, turn their papers into ash, I'd be sorely tempted.
I can give you names.
Write them down, said Locke. Write them all down. You're going to be tasting ink with your lunch, I'm afraid.
5. Tivoli's counting house was a classic of its type, a perfect cross between inviting extravagance and blatant intimidation. Locke admired the building. The narrow windows, like fortress embrasures, were girded with iron bars, and the shelves beneath the windows were cement blocks studded with broken glass. The exterior walls, all four of them, for the three-story building stood alone on a hard-packed dirt courtyard, were painted with well-executed frescoes of fat, infinitely content Gandolo blessing account books, scales and stacks of coin. The alchemical resin used to protect these images from the weather gave the walls a faint gleam, and Locke knew from personal experience it also made them devilishly hard to climb. The interior smelled of mellow incense. Golden lanterns hung in niches, casting a warm, inviting light, except where pillars and drapes contrived to create equally inviting pools of shadow. To either side, behind the main doors, guards sat on stools in gated alcoves, and a quick glance up confirmed that there was a tastefully concealed portcullis ready to be dropped, if not by the guards or bankers, then by hidden watchers behind the walls. There was no chance of robbing such a place on a whim, nor with anything less than a dozen armed and ready types, and even that was more likely to earn a bloodbath than a fortune. The shrine-like inviolability of houses like this was actually as necessary to those in the criminal line as it was to any honest citizen. There was no point in stealing well or wisely if the loot couldn't be stashed somewhere safe.
"'I see Nikoros in the carriage outside,' said a woman who emerged from behind a painted screen.
She was about 40, dark-skinned, with chestnut hair bound beneath a black silk skullcap. Her right eye was clouded, and she wore a pair of optics from which the corresponding lens had been removed.
"'You must be the political gentleman.'
"'Callas and Lazari,' said Jean.
"'Singular Tivoli, gentlemen. Your servant.'
"'Singular?' said Locke.
More elegant than only Tivoli, I find, and far more sociable than solitary Tivoli. You have some documents?
Locke handed over the papers they'd been given by Patience. Tivoli barely glanced at them before she nodded.
Private credit for 3,000 each, she said. Scratched these up myself a few days ago. Do you want to draw any of it?
Yes, said Jean. Can you give us 50 apiece?
That was adequate pocket money, thought Locke. Half a pound of Carthani ducats each. He turned the sum into Camori crowns in his head and idly reflected on what it could get him. A small company of mercenaries for several months, half a dozen outstanding horses, twice as many adequate ones, plain food and lodging for years. Not that he'd have any reason to buy such far-fetched things. Yet it would certainly procure an excellent dinner. His stomach rumbled at the thought.
"Might I offer you gentlemen some refreshment while the matter is tended to?"
Tivoli glanced at Locke. Were her ears that sharp?
"Dark ale? Wine? Pastries?"
"Yes," said Locke, resenting his weakness but unable to master it. "Yes, anything solid, that would be nice."
Gods above, he'd almost said necessary.
"Also," said Jean, "could we trouble you to have paper, ink and quills sent out to our carriage? Nikoros has some scribbling to do."
Tivoli settled Locke and Jean in one of the alcoves, on chairs that would have been at home in the suite of false furniture they'd given to Requin. An attendant brought a tray of flaky brown pastries in the Western style, filled with cheese and minced mushrooms. They were the richest thing Locke had eaten in weeks. Jean and Tivoli took small cups of dark ale and watched in joint bemusement as Locke removed the pastries from existence, rank by rank.
"I'm sorry," he said around a mouthful of food. "I've been ill. My stomach might as well have been locked up on another continent."
He knew he was being less than polite, but the alternative was to gnaw on more ship's biscuits, which he had transferred to an inner pocket of his new coat.
"Think nothing of it," said Tivoli. "Manners that would keep you starving are no manners worth respecting. Shall I call for more?"
Locke nodded, and in moments the surviving pastries received reinforcements. These were followed by an attendant carrying a wooden board with a neatly gridded surface, on which low stacks of gold and silver coins had been set out. Jean divided this money into two new leather purses while Locke continued eating.
"Now," said Tivoli, "I trust there's little more to say about your personal funds. The other matter we need to touch upon is a certain sum left in my care with strict instructions that it remain unrecorded. Before we discuss its handling, I must ask that you make absolutely no reference to my name in connection with this sum at any time, save in the utmost privacy between yourselves, certainly never in writing.
I assure you, madam, that in all matters of discretion not involving food, we make etiquette tutors look like slobbering barbarians," said Jean.
"Excellent," she said, rising from her chair. "Then let me acquaint you with the 100,000 ducats I'm not holding on your behalf."
6. The unrecorded sum lay in a windowless cell off an underground hallway guarded by clockwork doors that must have weighed half a ton apiece. A stack of iron-bound chests was set against an interior wall, and Tivoli pushed one open to reveal gleaming contents.
"About 750 pounds of gold," she said. "I can turn a fair percentage of it into silver without much notice, whenever you require."
"Yes, that may indeed be necessary before we're finished," said Locke.
He felt a strange tug at his heart. He'd taken the vast fortune of the gentleman bastards for granted for so long, and now here was another, set out for his disposal, as though the first had never been lost.
"Is there anyone besides yourselves," said Tivoli, "that you would wish to have access to these funds?"
"Absolutely not," said Jean. "And that's never to be countermanded," added Locke, "ever. No one else will come on our behalf. Anyone who says otherwise will be lying. Any evidence they produce should be torn up and stuffed down their breeches."
"We have, from long practice, developed many efficient means of dealing with mischief-makers," said Tivoli.
"May my associate and I speak privately?" said Locke.
"Of course."
Tivoli stepped out of the cell and pushed the door half-closed.
"This door will open from your side at just a touch of the silver lever. Take as long as you require."
When the door had clattered all the way shut, Jean closed the open chest and sat upon it.
"Your guts doing tumbling exercises like mine?"
"I'd never have credited it," said Locke, running his fingers over the cool wood of another strongbox. "All those years we spent stealing bigger and bigger sums, the money was like a painted backdrop for me. Now that we've had a couple fortunes yanked out from under us, though..."
"Yeah," said Jean, "it seems dearer somehow. This Tivoli, how far do you suppose we can trust her?"
"I think we can afford to assume the best in her case," said Locke. "Patience sent us here. Probably means that Sabatha can't touch our funds at their source, and that hers are equally beyond our reach. This is ammunition for the game. You'd want it kept safe for proper use if you were the Magi, wouldn't you?"
"You've saved me some explaining." The voice was deep, cultured, with a languid Karsani accent, and it came from right behind Locke. He whirled.
A man leaned against the door. He was about Locke's age and height, wearing a long coat the color of dried rose petals. His hair and short beard were icy blonde. Gloves, breeches, boots, and neckscarf were all black, without ornament.
"Gods," said Locke, regaining control of himself, "I would have opened the door for a knock."
"I didn't choose to wait," said the man.
"Well, I don't need to ask to see the rings on your wrist," said Locke. "Who are you, then? With patience or against?"
"With. I've come for a private word on behalf of all of us you stand to disappoint."
"We've been at work in your interest for about 4 hours now," said Locke. "Surely you could wait a day or two before coming at the total asshole. What do you think, Jean?"
"Jean is occupied," said the stranger.
Locke turned to see Jean with his eyes unfocused and mouth slightly open. Save for the faint rise and fall of his chest, he might have been a well-dressed statue.
"God's truth," said Locke, turning back to the stranger. "I don't care who you are. I am tired of talking to you fucking people under circumstances like..."
Before he finished his sentence, he threw a punch. Without betraying any surprise or concern, the mage caught Locke's fist in one of his gloved hands and struck back, straight to Locke's midsection. The strength bled from his legs and he went down, gasping. The mage retained his hold on Locke's hand and used it to wrench him around until he was on his knees facing away from his antagonist.
"Just breathe through the pain," said the mage casually. "Even for you, that was arrogant. You're no threat to anyone in your condition."
"T-T-Tivoli!" Locke gasped. "Tivoli!"
"Grow up."
The mage knelt behind him, put his left hand on Locke's jaw, and set the other in a choking hold. Locke kicked and struggled, but the man effortlessly maintained control of Locke's head and tightened the grip.
"She can't hear you either."
"Patience!" hissed Locke. "Patience will..."
"This conversation is never going to be any concern of hers. She isn't hovering over you like a little cloud. She has people like me to do that for her."
"Fucking bastard!"
"Yes," said the mage, loosening his choke at last.
Locke coughed and sucked air into his burning lungs.
"Yes, I do want for manners, don't I? And you're such a gentle, saint-like fellow yourself. Are you ready to listen?"
Locke, relieved to be breathing again and deeply ashamed of his weakened state, said nothing.
"The message is this," continued the mage, taking silence for acquiescence. "We want the contest to be genuine. We want to see you work for 6 weeks. If you make peace with that woman and contrive some sort of dumb show..."
"Patience already warned me," coughed Locke. "Gods above, you must have known that, you tedious piece of shit!"
"It's one thing to be told. It's another thing to understand. You've got a real entanglement with the woman on the other side. We have to be idiots not to allow that you might be tempted."
"I've already promised..."
"Your promises aren't worth a dead man's spit, Kamori. So here's something tangible.
Make any arrangement with your red-headed friend to fix this contest in either direction, and we'll kill her.
You son of a... You can't!
Of course we can. Just as soon as the election is over. We'll take our time while you watch.
The other mages...
You think they give a damn about her? The Falconer's friends? They hired her to vex you. Once the 5-year game is over, there'll be no protection.
Locke attempted to stumble to his feet, and after a moment the mage yanked him up by the back of his coat. Locke turned, glared, and made a show of dusting himself off.
It's no use giving me the evil eye, Lamora. Take the warning to heart. You should be flattered that we understand how useless half-measures are with you.
Flattered, said Locke. Oh, yeah, flattered. That's exactly the word that was on the tip of my tongue. Thanks.
The woman is a hostage to your good behavior. You don't get another reminder. And don't bother telling patients about this either. You'd suffer for it.
That all?
That's all the conversation I have in me, friend.
Then wake Jean up.
He'll stop daydreaming once I've gone.
Too chicken shit to say this sort of thing in front of him?
Hasn't it occurred to you, said the mage, that the last thing your partner needs is another one of my kind proving just how helpless he is while he's awake to bear the disgrace?
I'm
not without my sympathies, Lamora. They just don't necessarily reside with you. Now mind the job we hired you for.
With a wave of his hand, he was gone. Locke swung his arms around the empty air where the mage had been standing, then patted the nearby wall, then checked to make sure the door was still tightly closed. He gave a grunt of disgusted resignation and massaged his neck.
Locke? Did you say something?
Jean was back on his feet, looking hale.
No, Jean, I'm sorry. I just, coughed. Are you all right?
Jean peered at him over the rims of his optics.
You're sweating like mad. Did something happen?
It's just... nothing. Gods above, the red-coated bastard was right. Jean didn't need another reminder of how casually the Magi could make a puppet of him. With Locke barely started on the path to recovery, he needed all of Jean's confidence and energy, without distraction.
I'm sure it's just all this walking about. I'll get used to it again soon enough.
Well then, let's have Nikoros take us to our lodgings, said Jean.
We've got clothes, we're in funds. Let's see to your comfort before we start the good fight on behalf of Patience and her cohorts.
Right, said Locke, reaching for the lever that would open the cell door. Last people in the world I'd want to disappoint. 7.
Nikoros, who the hell votes in this place anyway? Asked Locke as the carriage bobbed and weaved its way across one of the elderglass suspension bridges, headed northwest for somewhere Nikoros had called the Palanta district.
Well, there's, 3 ways to earn the right. You can show title to property worth at least 60 ducats, you can serve in the constabulary for 25 years, or you can be enfranchised for a lump sum of 150 at any time except the actual day of an election.
Hmm, said Locke. Sounds like an eminently corruptible process. That might be useful.
So how many people in Carthane and how many can vote?
About 70,000 in the city, said Nikoros,
who was sitting awkwardly indeed, protecting the stack of parcels with one hand and gently waving a still-drying sheet of parchment with the other.
5,000 with voting rights, more or less. I'll have more precise figures as the election goes on.
That's what, about 250 voters per consale seat, said Jean, or am I wrong?
Close enough. You're allowed to choose one of the 2 final candidates in whatever district you live in. Ballots are in writing, and you've got to be able to sign your name, too.
So, as far as voting goes, we're not really looking at 1 big fight, but 19 smaller ones.
Indeed. If I may, I believe this list is dry.
Jean took it.
He scanned the columns of chicken scratch handwriting. No wonder Nikoros had a long-standing relationship with a trustworthy scribe, a short list of businesses, and a longer list of names.
"These people make the Black Iris Party tick?"
"Our counterparts, yes. They call themselves the Trust. We always refer to ourselves as the Committee."
"When can we meet this committee?" said Jean.
"Well, actually, I had hoped you wouldn't mind a bit of a get-together this evening. Just the committee and select Deep Root supporters."
"How many?"
"Not above 150.
"Gods below," said Locke.
"I suppose we'll have to do it sooner or later, though. Where did you want to hold this mess?"
"At your lodgings. Justin's comprehensive accommodations. I'm eager for you to see it. It's the best place in the city, our temple for Deep Roots affairs."
A temple that could have been, given its size. They pulled up before Justin's just as the sun was reaching its mild zenith in a sky that was gradually graying over with clouds. Porters scrambled from the building's shaded front entrance and took packages under Nikoros' direction. Jean hopped out of the carriage before Locke did and studied the structure. It was a sprawling, gabled, three-story affair with at least 9 visible chimneys and several dozen windows. A dozen carriages could have lined up before it with room to spare.
"Hell of an inn," said Locke as his shoes hit the cobbles.
"Not just an inn," said Nikoros. "A fine dining establishment, a complete bar, a coffee-house. Paradise on earth for merchants and traders with party sympathies. A quarter of the city's commerce gets hashed out here."
The interior lived up to Nikoros' enthusiasm. At least 5 dozen men and women drank and conversed at long tables amidst solid, darkly varnished wooden pillars. An entire clothier's shop worth of hats and coats hung from nearly every surface, and waiters in black jackets and breeches bustled about with the haste of siege engineers preparing an attack. To Jean's eye, the place looked like Miragio's turned inside out, with the dining and drinking made a centerpiece of business affairs rather than a concealed luxury.
"Up there," said Nikoros, gesturing toward raised galleries with polished brass rails, "you'll find the reserved sections. One for the biggest syndicates, the ones I write for. Another for the scribes and solicitors. They pay the house a ransom to stay close to the action. And there's a gallery for Deep Roots business."
Jean sensed the number of eyes upon him, and although Nikoros drew waves and nods from onlookers, it was obvious that the 2 gentlemen bastards had become objects of curiosity merely by walking in with him. Jean sighed inwardly, thinking that a back door entrance might have been wiser, but the die was cast. If Sabatha hadn't already known they were loose on the streets of Carthane, it was inconceivable that at least one person here wasn't in her employ, watching for their arrival. Behind the well-furnished bar on the far side of the room was a tall black man, thin as a hat rack, wearing a more expensive version of the waiter's uniform under a billowing white cravat and leather apron. The instant he caught sight of Nikoros, he set down the ledger he was reading and crossed the room, dodging waiters.
"Welcome, sirs, welcome to Justin's Comprehensive, the hall-inclusive."
The man bowed at the waist before Locke and Jean.
"Diligence Justin, gentlemen, master of the house. You're expected. How can I make your life easier?"
"I'd do public murder for a cup of coffee," said Jean.
"You've come to the only house in Carthane with coffee worth murdering for. We have 7 distinct blends, from the aromatic Siresti dry to the thick."
"I'll take the kind I don't have to think about."
"The very best kind of all."
Justin snapped his fingers, and a nearby waiter hurried off.
"Now, your rooms. They're in the west wing, 2nd floor, a pair of joint suites, and I'll have your things..."
"Yes, yes," said Locke. "Forgive me, I require a moment."
He grabbed Jean and Nikoros by their lapels and dragged them into a private huddle.
"This innkeeper," whispered Locke. "How far can we trust him, Nikoros?"
"He's been Deep Roots since this place was 3 bricks and some post-holes in the mud. Gods above, Lazari, he's as likely to turn as I am."
"What makes you think we trust you?"
I...
"Take a breath, I'm kidding."
Locke patted Nikoros on the back and smiled.
"If you're wrong, of course, we're buggered as all hell. Justin, my dear fellow,
Yes, have our junks sent to our rooms. I'm sure they're perfect, with just the right number of walls and ceilings. I'll count them later. You know why we're here?
Why, to help us kick the black iris in the teeth for a change, and to enjoy your coffee.
A waiter appeared at Jean's side, offering a steaming mug on a brass tray. Jean took it and swallowed half of it in one gulp, shuddering with pleasure as the heat cascaded down his battle-hardened gullet.
"Oh, yes," he said. "That's the stuff. Sweet liquid death, with just a hint of ginger."
"Oh, canty beans," said Justin. "My family once grew them on the home islands before we came north."
"Feeling human again?" said Locke. "This brew could make a dead eunuch piss lightning," said Jean.
He tossed back the second half of the cup.
"You want to go up and rest?"
"Gods, no," said Locke. "Time is precious, security's non-existent, and our collective ass is hanging in the wind, just begging a certain someone to put an arrow right between the cheeks. Justin, I've got to make cruel use of you, I'm afraid."
"Name any requirement. I'll meet it eye to eye."
"Good man, but you'll learn soon enough not to say that sort of thing to me until I've finished speaking, and then you'll probably learn not to say nice things at all. Your waiters, porters, and the like, have you hired any new ones in the last week?"
"Five or six."
"Get their names on paper. Get that paper to Master Callus here."
Locke jerked a thumb at Jean.
"Instruct your most trusted employees to watch your newest hirelings at all times. Don't do anything but get full reports of their activities."